www.wordsmith.org. From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. 2003 was a remarkable year in news. Who will ever forget the image of Saddam's statue toppling in Baghdad, or a scraggly, captured Saddam being checked for head lice, of the space shuttle Columbia disintegrating into a streak of vapor, or the streets of Hong Kong and Toronto filled with people wearing surgical masks for fear of SARS? 2003 was a remarkable year for On Point, too. We brought you Madeleine Albright, Jack Welch, Jordan's Queen Noor, Howard Dean, Wesley Clark, Joan Baez, and Tom Daschle, among many, many others. But just as important, we brought you the voices of you, our callers and our radio diarists, listeners, journalists, thinkers, and doers who put a human face on the news we cover every day. Tonight, we're bringing you the best of On Point's radio diaries from 2003. We begin tonight with a moment in the run-up to the story of the year, the war in Iraq. Like many Americans, Kirsten Schoenberg used to associate war with green streaks of light on television, but that was before the Chicago Tribune reporter became one of hundreds of embedded journalists covering the war in Iraq. Schoenberg lived and ate and slept with the 101st Airborne Division before and during the conflict. In this radio diary, written from Camp New Jersey in Kuwait, just days before the war began, Kirsten Schoenberg reflected on how her stay with the 101st Airborne had transformed her view of war and her career.
When I was younger, fresh out of journalism school, I would salivate at big and therefore usually bad news. I wanted the assignment. I wanted to grab the notebook and go. I wanted to record that moment in time, be it a plane crash or a triple homicide or a bank robbery gone wrong. It's not that I liked when the world turned ugly. I hated to see the heartache. But the stories had to be covered, and because I was green and willing and mobile, I soon found myself riding what journalists call the disaster circuit. Oklahoma City, Ground Zero, 9 miners trapped in Pennsylvania, a rail car of dead illegal immigrants in Iowa. Then, over Thanksgiving, I got a call from one of my editors at the Chicago Tribune asking whether I'd cover the war in Iraq if it came to that. Would I learn how to probe for landmines and don my gas mask in less than 9 seconds? Would I live in a tent in the middle of the desert and get to know the soldiers? And would I go north with American troops into battle? That turned out to be the course of action. Of course. So here I am at Camp New Jersey in Kuwait. For more than 2 weeks, I've been with the famed 101st Airborne. I share a tent with them. I eat bad military food with them. I joke around with them and pepper them with questions and debate the news of the day. When the soldiers ask me what I do for a living, what kind of stories I write, I tell them about the disaster circuit. They tell me they hope I don't bring them bad luck. I laughed at first when they all started telling me that. But the more I think about it, at night when the tent is dark and quiet and I try to imagine what is to come, I realize that for once I'd be more than happy to go home without covering big news. It's immaterial how I feel about military action in Iraq. What it really comes down to is simply this. I spend my days with soldiers who might die for their country, and it sobers me. War became an antiseptic, see it in green bursts of light on CNN kind of affair during the 1991 Persian Gulf War. Because our casualties were so few, war seemed far away and minimally dangerous. It doesn't feel that way to me anymore. I now know a private who named his gun Joanna, but who blushes and refuses to tell me why. I know a chaplain who found out on the day he shipped out that his wife was expecting their first child. I know a specialist who wants to go to college after the war so he can become an Army officer. And I know so much more. I know which young sergeants pray before dinner. I know the names of many of the officers' children. I know which guys spend their downtime playing video games, and which ones fall asleep listening to country music, and which ones read sci-fi thrillers faster than their wives can send them new ones. I know which guys were on their way out of the Army until war crept nearer. There have been endless newsroom debates in the months since the Pentagon announced its intent to embed hundreds of journalists with the military and to allow them to cover from the front lines any war that might happen. A lot of people worry that we will become too close to our sources to be objective, or that any coverage we do will be discredited because we will be seen as mouthpieces for America. Those are valid concerns, and I find myself walking a fine ethical line drawn in the sand. For example, my colonel wants me to wear camouflage if I am out on missions with his soldiers, so I don't compromise them and me. I worry that dressing like them might blur the line that should separate a journalist from her subjects. I haven't yet decided what I will do about that, and the issue probably will be moot because I will likely have to wear the full military-issue biochemical suit if we do roll north. But I'm starting to think that the most probable result of being out here with these soldiers is not that I'll lose my objectivity, but that I'll fine-tune my humanity. When I sit across from a soldier at dinner, talking about how he's worried that his daughter has taken up smoking or that his wife's brother died while he's been gone, I find myself thinking that objectivity is a non-issue here. My time at Camp New Jersey has impressed upon me how human war is, and I won't forget that if Bush gives the go-ahead to fight Iraq. If I see an American soldier die, I'll be saddened. If I see an Iraqi tank blow up, I'll be saddened. I'm not a pacifist, and I don't buy the argument that war is never necessary, only that it is always horrific. After watching Union soldiers being mowed down at the 1862 Battle of Fredericksburg, Confederate General Robert E. Lee said, "It is well that war is so terrible, or we should grow too fond of it." That quote applies to journalists, too. We should never get so accustomed to covering bad news that it no longer depresses us or shocks us or makes us weep. A few days ago, I hiked through the sands outside our camp to watch a platoon practice overtaking replicas of entrenched bunkers. While the officers were running through the drill, a seasoned officer confided to me, "If we ever have to do this, a lot of these guys will die. A lot. This is a high casualty kind of mission." "Do they know that?" I asked him. "Do you level with them and say it just like that?" "No," he told me. "They know it's dangerous, but we don't say it quite so directly." After the exercise, the soldiers, sweaty and red-faced and spent, gathered around their officers to dissect what had just happened. While the officer was critiquing how they had performed and the things they should do differently the next time, I looked around and wondered whose deaths I might have to write about. I'm confident that I'll be an objective reporter if the U.S. goes to war. If I see innocent civilians die, I'll report that. If I see generals make bad decisions that lead to many casualties, I'll report that. If I see soldiers break laws of the Geneva Convention and mistreat surrendering Iraqis, I'll report that. But I know my experience among the soldiers also will ensure that I am a very human reporter in any conflict that may come. War will not be big news. It will be as tangible and three-dimensional as the soldier sitting next to me at dinner.
Kirsten Charnberg is a reporter with the Chicago Tribune. She was embedded with the 101st Airborne Division during the war in Iraq. Her piece came to us in March, just before the war began. While American troops were preparing to invade Iraq, other Americans were doing what they could to stop the war from happening. Patty Perrin had never considered herself a peace activist. In fact, it took some arm twisting to get the Ashland, Oregon resident to take part in a last-ditch anti-war rally in her small town. But as she stood alongside nearly 200 fellow women protesters, Patty began to realize she was giving voice to a group that had been nearly silent in the raging debate over Iraq. In this radio diary from before the invasion, Patty Perrin reflected on her stint as an anti-war activist.
"I am a woman in black. For half an hour last week, I stood dressed all in black beside the main street of my town, staring silently ahead. When I began my vigil, I was uncertain why I was there and probably would not have gone except that an activist friend made me feel guilty. 'They need more white hair,' she explained. 'If we don't show up, who will?' I didn't want to go, but I also knew I felt terribly frustrated and unlistened to. Maybe this would help. I know war. I lost all my teen years to war. I lost my son's youth to war. And if standing there I could make a difference, I had to try. It was a very cold day, so I put on layer after layer of clothing, knowing the standing would intensify the cold. Ashland is a small town, yet 180 women, all ages, gathered and stood shoulder to shoulder along our main street. On one side of me was my old friend, on the other a much younger woman who wore sunglasses on a cloudy day. One woman had brought a child, a little girl about 4, dressed all in black, a somber, quiet child. Our vigil was only a half hour, but standing still in the cold for half an hour is difficult. But I soon got my body adjusted. I watched the cars going by. Some of the people in the cars honked, and others were careful not to look at us. Physically, I began to quiet down, but not my mind. It flitted. The question kept coming up, why was I here? I watched the trees across the street and noted they were starting to bud. Yes, there will be a spring, I said to myself. I wanted to focus on anything except what I was doing. Someone, as we were gathering, had suggested that we pray, so I began. I find myself reverting to the prayers of my childhood, the rosary. Hail Mary, full of grace. The rhythm of the prayer quieted me, and it seemed apt that I be addressing another mother. My mind began to focus on my task, and I realized I was there because women the world over are not being heard. I was standing there for all women, and especially the women of Iraq. I found myself imagining some Iraqi woman standing beside me, maybe the lady in the sunglasses. She would be some mother who also loves her country, her home, and her family, a woman who does not want to be bombed, an Islamic mother. Holy Mary, Mother of God, pray for us sinners now and at the hour of our death.
Patty Perrin is a freelance writer and writing teacher. She lives in Ashland, Oregon. Her diary came to us in March. SARS became a household word this spring when thousands of residents of Toronto, Hong Kong, and other parts of the world came down with a contagious respiratory infection. People roamed streets of Asia and Ontario wearing surgical masks for fear of the disease. Toronto resident Margaret Wente said SARS was all anyone could talk about in her hometown. In this radio diary from April, she wondered which was worse, the disease or the paranoia it had wrought.
Here in SARS land, we don't do social kissing anymore. The other person could deposit germs on you. Shaking hands is dicey, too. The other day I forgot and hugged a friend of mine who recoiled in horror from my unsanitary embrace. I won't do that again. The most unpleasant side effect of SARS is that it forces you to focus on bodily fluids you'd rather ignore, such as saliva, snot, spit, and mucus. Invisible poison droplets can be anywhere, and you can't be too vigilant. Certain of my friends have become obsessed with discussing these miasmic substances, even at the nicest dinner parties. Public washrooms are the worst, said someone over the fettuccine course the other night. Even if you wash your hands, you have to touch the doorknob, and who knows who touched it just before you. In Toronto these days, there is only one story, germs. Half the time I think we're wildly overreacting, and half the time I think we're doing the right thing, says a doctor who was forced to sacrifice his beard. He'd had it for 33 years, but it had to go because his mask wouldn't work properly with it. Already, the authorities are hinting about electronic ankle bracelets for people who refuse to stay in quarantine. Pretty soon, Toronto could be like Singapore. But no one's objecting because civil liberties are no match for germs that run amok. Singing is an excellent way to spread this, said Dr. Sheila Basrur, explaining why so many evangelical churchgoers got sick. Dr. Basrur is Toronto's overworked medical officer of health. She hasn't outlawed hymns yet, but Easter services this year were contact-free. No icon kissing or communion wine. No shaking hands either. Even confessional boxes have been banned because people in them breathe too much on each other. Dr. Basrur has become a familiar face on CNN, where SARS is now as big a story as the war in Iraq. The New York Times has been prominently running SARS stories all week. Consequently, Americans have decided that Toronto is more dangerous than Baghdad. Walmart, Goldman Sachs, and Lisa Marie Presley have all boycotted us. Harvard University has told its staff and students not to set foot anywhere in Ontario. We have 19,000 lives under our protection, explained a Harvard official the other day, somewhat snottily, I thought. But how can you blame him when people at my health club want to ban anyone who sneezes? The only thing that spreads faster than germs is paranoia. Meantime, I am trying to adapt to the new social norms. I'm trying to keep my droplets to myself, even though I honestly believe they're harmless. No more singing, kissing, hugging, handshaking, or air kissing. I already gave up confessing years ago. I'm practicing how to bow politely, like the Japanese. I'm trying not to think about other people's droplets, but it's hard.
Margaret Winty is a columnist with the Globe and Mail newspaper. She lives in Toronto, Ontario. She sent us her diary in April. We'll have more after a short break. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to On Point's Best Radio Diaries of 2003. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Tonight we're bringing you the best of On Point's radio diaries from the past year. We turn back now to the war in Iraq. Thanks to the Embedded Journalist program, Iraq turned out to be the most closely watched war in history. But despite the nonstop media coverage, very little attention was paid to the Iraqi soldiers who died in battle. Princeton University professor Uwe Reinhardt says this, unfortunately, is the way of war. In this radio diary from March, Professor Reinhardt remembers a lesson he learned from childhood, that every death in war is a human death.
CNN recently showed a Marine chaplain admonishing the platoon assembled before him. "Pray not only for yourself," he told them, "but for your enemies as well. After all, they are just soldiers, like you, doing what they are ordered to do." What a refreshing departure these words were from what I've been hearing from the civilian sector, particularly the media, where the talk is mainly of minimizing coalition casualties or, in more generous moments, innocent Iraqi civilian casualties as well. I wince every time I hear that kind of talk, especially the reference to innocence. Should not the proper minimum in any war be the loss of human life, period? Which in this case includes Iraqi soldiers as well. My earliest childhood memories were forged by war, real war. My family lived near one of the most ferocious battlegrounds of the European war theater, the notorious Hürtgen Forest, where American and German soldiers fought one another for more than 4 months in the fall of 1944. A plaque at one of the military cemeteries in the area notes that more American soldiers died there than in Vietnam, and surely as many or more German soldiers were killed there too. My family lived opposite a convent that had been converted into a field hospital for the nearby front. I was a small boy then, and watching the ambulances come and go, and sometimes peeking curiously into them, I could not help but become witness daily to the horrors of war. Millions of Europeans of my generation, who many Americans now disparage so contemptuously as pacifists, had a similar experience. Because we lived so near the Battle of the Bulge and the advancing Allied forces, our village was strafed and bombed routinely. One such attack came as my friends and I were playing outside. We ran as the planes approached, taking shelter in the cavernous basement of the convent. There we spied a row of stretchers. On each was a body, covered entirely by a blanket. Possibly to overcome our own terror, we dared one another to pull back a blanket on one of the stretchers to see what a dead man looked like. Someone did. We felt silent instantly as we beheld the serene, waxen face of a very young soldier who could not have been older than 16 or 17. More than 50 years later, I can still see his face clearly. The shock of it recurs whenever I hear the chirpy anchors on the morning programs, not to mention the hawkish talking heads, prattle on about innocent civilians as if the number of fallen enemy soldiers did not count. What does innocent mean in the context of war? I'm almost certain that the young German soldier my friends and I saw so many years ago in that convent was as innocent as those of us who weren't in uniform. For all we know, he had grown up on a farm somewhere and, while fighting in the trenches, dreamt of his girlfriend and of life as an adult in peaceful times. For all we know, he would have happily quit fighting and joined the Allies. He didn't have much of a choice. Some German generals strung up on trees the bodies of young soldiers who had deserted, a powerful warning to their peers. Perhaps many of the Iraqi soldiers, too, find themselves where they are because they have no other choice. After all, is not Saddam Hussein a ruthless dictator, and are not some of his generals likely to be as cruel as their Wehrmacht counterparts? It should be clear that I am not speaking here of the cowardly Iraqi soldiers who dress up as civilians, hide among civilians, and shoot at our troops, exploiting the very trademark of American soldiers, that is, the good care they take not to harm civilians. Such cowards dressed up as civilians are scum. In World War II, they were shot on the spot by both sides, and they should be shot on the spot these days. But my hope is that Americans can muster the proper decorum that an enterprise as horrible as war demands. There's nothing neat about maiming and killing people with precision bombs from the air or gunfire on the ground, even if they're wearing enemy uniforms. Young lives are snuffed out. Parents, siblings, and lovers weep. And so should we. We want our troops to win a quick victory, to be sure. As the father of a young Marine officer on the front lines in Iraq, I certainly do. But let us heed that Marine chaplain who, like anyone else who has ever witnessed war, knows whereof he speaks. Let us hope and pray for a minimum loss of human life. Period.
Uwe Reinhardt is a professor of political economy at Princeton University. His diary came to us in March. When opponents of California's former governor, Gray Davis, garnered enough signatures to force a recall election, it set off a gold rush of candidates seeking the state's highest office. 135 candidates, including one named Schwarzenegger, threw their hats into the ring. Among these politicians were a porn star, a watermelon-smashing comedian, and actor Gary Coleman. But California resident Jamie O'Neill was not among those seeking the governorship. In this radio diary from August, he explains why.
As one of that mere handful of Californians not running for governor of the state, I feel compelled to explain why I am so out of step with so many of my fellow citizens. Led by porn peddler Larry Flint, pint-sized former child actor Gary Coleman, and super-sized movie icon Arnold Schwarzenegger, a legion of Californians have filed the necessary papers announcing their desire to replace Governor Gray Davis. In each and every one of those wannabe gubernatorial heads is a thought, hell, I could do better than this guy. It is, as they say, an easy thought to think. As everyone knows by now, since virtually everyone is running, the current gold rush toward Sacramento began with the recall drive launched by Daryl Issa, reform car thief turned annoyance peddler. Issa apparently thought that all of California's problems could easily be pinned on the governor, and so he sent out a small army of paid signature collectors to fix what was broken by throwing out the governor and taking the job for himself. But as soon as the recall drive garnered enough signatures to force the recall election, nearly everyone wanted to play. California certainly has no monopoly on nutballs, though it is getting harder and harder to convince the rest of the nation of that. While we here in the Golden State go through the political paroxysm caused by Daryl Issa's vanity, the rest of the country can barely contain its glee. And they probably haven't even heard about Mary Carey, a 22-year-old porn actress who is seeking election based on her platform of offering to swap X-rated videos for guns. Her solution for the problem of global warming? Wear less clothes. Then there's Gallagher, the watermelon-smashing comedian. He's in, and so is Kevin Richter of Pleasanton, who claims to be the cheapest person on the planet. His cure for the state's budget woes? The state should shop at Costco. There's also a former Oakland cop who is running on the slogan, No Crybabies. It's just amazing how many good ideas turn up when democracy runs amok. California has always been an object of envy. We're too favored, with good weather, a grand and beautiful coast, a glamorous entertainment industry, a varied topography, the richest agricultural land in the world, and a free and easy lifestyle. With that kind of bounty comes spitefulness. My relatives back east have always loved shaking their heads in puzzlement over why anyone would choose to live in a place where the ground under one's feet is so unstable. Every earthquake is a reassurance that they made the right choice to stay where the average winter temperature is, roughly zero. In the words of Midwestern folk wisdom, California is the land of fruits and nuts. Our current political circus proves the nuts part, and they just couldn't be happier about that. The Democrats here were going to stand firm behind Gray Davis, but the infectious desire to be the person to replace him has proved irresistible. Lieutenant Governor Cruz Bustamante has declared his candidacy. Bustamante is a very short guy. If he and Gary Coleman were stacked end to end, they might manage to see eye to eye with Arnold, the Terminator, although Arnold himself isn't all that tall. He just plays a tall guy in the movies. If that seems silly, then just survey our current situation. Groucho Marx famously observed that he would not join a club that would have him as a member. And that's why I'm nearly unique in not running for governor of California. That club is just too casual about who it will take as its members.
Jamie O'Neill teaches writing at Butte College. He lives in Magalia, California. His diary first aired in August. In May, the news media was rattled by a scandal at the New York Times. Reporter Jason Blair, who covered major stories like the D.C. sniper and Private Jessica Lynch, admitted he had fabricated facts in many of his reports. Some responded that Jason Blair was able to get away with his deception for so long because he was African American. But in this radio diary from May, columnist Eugene Kane said those trying to blame the Blair scandal on racial politics were missing the point.
There was once a black reporter named Janet Cook who became a scourge for any young African-American trying to break into journalism. These days, it's Jason Blair, but the effect will likely be the same. Cook was the Washington Post reporter who won a Pulitzer Prize in 1981 for a series she made up about an 8-year-old heroin addict. She was subsequently disgraced when the truth was revealed and the paper had to return the prize. Her deceit left a large, looming shadow over an entire generation of young black journalists trying to get their feet in the door at a major newspaper. I know. I was one of them. Black friends who worked at the Washington Post during that time often told me the entire newsroom seemed to turn a suspicious eye on the work of any black reporters after the Cook fiasco. It happened at lots of other places. Nobody mentions Cook much anymore. You can bet, from now on, they will mention Blair. After reading a 13,800-word account of Blair's transgressions in the Sunday New York Times, some pundits are questioning whether Blair's long record of incompetence would have been tolerated if he weren't black. Some have even claimed Blair is a prime example why affirmative action is flawed. But if you read the New York Times account, it's obvious the main heads that need to roll belong to top editors who either ignored or disregarded numerous warning flags during a young man's career as an erratic intern and cub reporter. What also becomes apparent, Blair didn't get ahead because of his journalism skills or lack thereof. He rose through the ranks because he was a consummate brown noser, an office politician who sucked up the big name editors, black and white. After learning of the spectacular enormity of Blair's deceit, it seems ridiculous to treat his situation as anything more than a chilling tale of a pathological liar who found himself working for the nation's most famous newspaper. For those ready to jump on his blackness to justify their own hard-hearted attitudes towards affirmative action, I've already heard from some of you. There's nothing in his sad tale to suggest black reporters need to hang their heads in shame. Contrary to what some believe, young blacks don't usually waltz into jobs at the New York Times. It's a white enclave. The Times is still trying to create a newsroom reflective of society. As for any black mark on the business from Blair, here's the ultimate reality check. Mike Barnicle was a white Boston Globe columnist who resigned for making up columns. Stephen Glass is a white writer who is just on 60 Minutes Sunday, delivering his latest mea culpa for fabricating numerous stories. And don't forget the white reporters at the Salt Lake Tribune who sold stories to the National Enquirer. Journalism is about finding the truth. When you lie, it makes that ideal more elusive, no matter what your color.
Eugene Kane is a columnist with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. His diary came to us in May. Ramadan began in late October this year. Muslims around the world fasted from dawn to dusk in observation of the holiest month of the Islamic calendar. San Francisco Muslim Asma Hassan told us that a month's worth of planning meals around sunrise and sunset is hard enough, but being away from family and a culture that cherishes Ramadan made things even more difficult. In this radio diary from November, Asma Hassan says being an urban American 20-something Muslim gives Ramadan an entirely new meaning.
I'm not celebrating Ramadan the way my mother did in Pakistan, or even the way I did as a child in Colorado. My mom's Ramadan dining table was filled with South Asian delicacies. She and her brothers, sister, and parents would gather just before sunset to open their fasts for the iftar meal. freshly fried onion fritters with mint chutney, spicy lamb chops with tamarind and plum chutney, soft, hot, doughy naans, as well as fried tortilla-type bread called pratas, chicken tikka with another kind of bread called chapatis, pudding made of carrots grown on my grandfather's farm, and other sweet dishes called halva. My mother and her siblings would sit before this grand table, eyeing the items that my grandmother had spent the whole day preparing and whose scent filled their home. For me, this same rite of opening the fast includes warming leftover pasta in my microwave. If I'm feeling spunky, I might order Indian food for delivery. My dinner companion is Alex Trebek, hosting Jeopardy. I pray by myself and then decide whether or not to go to the gym. The only scent filling my apartment is from my neighbor's evening cigar. If I were married, as I should have been 10 years ago under Pakistani cultural standards, I would not be opening my fast alone. And this Ramadan, like me, many Gen X Muslim women are also fasting alone. According to statistics compiled by the Islamic Society of North America, American Muslim women in their 20s and 30s outnumber Muslim men in the same age group 2-to-1. Ramadan is family time. My mother and her family, for instance, after eating the feast at iftar, would pray together and then have another meal, dinner, together, where they would discuss the day's events and plan the next day's fast. One of the purposes behind Ramadan is to learn what suffering feels like, to experience what those who are hungry do every day. Waking up alone in the early morning hours, by myself, in the dark, to eat a pre-dawn breakfast is not easy. When I fast at my parents' home, I usually have a family member to cajole or entertain me, or my mother will simply stay up all night just to make sure that I wake up in time, and then she'll make me her own version of her mother's feast. But to fast alone, to fast single, makes the process more alienating than it already is. Eating eggs and burnt toast at 5 a.m., watching a Saudi Malvi recite the Quran on cable, is a far cry from the eventful Ramadan gatherings my mother told me about when I was little. Ramadan single is perhaps, in a way, reaching a truer meaning of Ramadan. Although families observe Ramadan as a unit, Ramadan is actually not meant to be fun. Ramadan alone is more suffering than Ramadan together. It can make you more sympathetic to the plight of those who are hungry and helpless and alone. For those who fast the full 30 days with sincerity, great rewards are promised. Hopefully, for single Muslim women, a mate will be one of them.
Asma Hassan is a writer and law associate. Her new book, Why I Am a Muslim, will be published in March. She lives in San Francisco. I'm Tom Ashbrook. More of our best radio diaries from 2003 after a short break. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Tonight, we're bringing you the best radio diaries of 2003. When Pittsburgh writer Brian Conley looks at his daughter, he sees someone on the opposite end of the political spectrum. In this radio diary from September, he reflected on his own ever-increasing conservatism and his daughter's effortless liberalism.
My daughter has become a tree-hugging, kumbaya-singing liberal. Everybody, she thinks, wants a kiss and a flower. She enthusiastically embraces ethnic, cultural, and gender diversity in her friendships. Selfish people baffle her, and she could never support anything as violent as the invasion of Iraq. She hates it when people or animals are scared. She would certainly attend a gay wedding, especially if they had balloons. She's 2.5 years old. Winston Churchill said a person who is not liberal when young has no heart. So my toddler is obviously far to the left. She has no agenda and belongs to no organization. I guess you could call her an anarchist. Unfortunately, Churchill also said a person should be conservative when old. An old daddy is growing more conservative by the day. When I look around my daughter and think about her future, it is not the vast majority of kind and sensible people that I see, but cowardly politicians, bad parents, rude children, fast drivers, and people with pit bulls. Any notions of understanding or reforming these people are gone. They're menaces. I watch them warily at the borders of my daughter's happy world. These people are really just nuisances, but people driven by real evil reached out for our happy world. My daughter was born about 6 months before September 11th, 2001. I was home with her on my lap all through that Tuesday, watching all that death on television, waiting for my wife to come home. My daughter's presence and unawareness were my comfort. It's become a bit of a joke to say that September 11th changed America. If the Osbournes and college football go on, we ask, what's changed? But I know that I've changed. I flatter myself that the relationship with my daughter contains a metaphor for the war on terror. When military guys would say that they fight a war to protect people's right to protest the war, I used to be skeptical. Now the idea makes sense. I'm certainly less popular now that I'm a father. I'm less tolerant, less easygoing. I have less time for people. For now, probably for a long time, there is one thing in the world that matters very much to me. The rest of the world has to matter less. It makes me sad sometimes. I've always prided myself on being good company. 2 years ago, I was a better person. A quote sticks with me from historian Barbara Tuchman's book, The Proud Tower, about the years leading up to World War I. Belgian socialist poet Emile Verhaeren, soon to die at the front, looked back at life before 1914 and dedicated his last book, with emotion, to the man I used to be. Someday I hope to be back in the world as the man I used to be. For now, my daughter put so much love into that world that it more than makes up for my absence. I'm content to play the guard dog for her life and her spirit. The more conservative me, I tell myself, helps my liberal daughter stay that way for as long as she can. Her generous soul is my heart and my hope. I don't root for the conservative me or the conservatives prosecuting the war on terror. Like the war, we are grim facts. The very best part of us as a country, and the very best part of me, lies elsewhere. When the smoke clears, I hope that we can still find those best parts.
Brian Conley is a writer and editor. He lives in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, with his wife and his 2.5-year-old daughter, Sophia. Millions of Americans have been taking to the skies this holiday season, and with all those passengers comes an avalanche of luggage for the Transportation Security Administration to screen. New York writer Beth Pinsker knows firsthand the difficult task facing airline baggage screeners. She worked for the TSA for 3 months in 2003. In August, she read her radio diary, Confessions of a Baggage Screener.
The suitcase was ticking. It was my third week on the job as one of 55,000 new airport screeners employed by the Transportation Security Administration, and the first day of the war in Iraq. The nationwide terror alert was in orange, and a pair of National Guardsmen patrolled the sprawling departure lobby of the U.S. Airways terminal at LaGuardia, rifles at the ready, gas masks strapped to their thighs. All of this made the egg timer click coming from the bag a matter of some urgency. I had picked up the suitcase after it was singled out by one of the cream-colored SUV-sized machines that X-ray check luggage. I put it on a metal examination table, as I had been trained to do, and swabbed the surface with a cloth-tipped wand. It tested negative in the explosive trace detector. I unzipped the bag gingerly and faced a jumble of women's clothes, mostly polyester and flowered, then stuck in a latex-gloved hand to feel for solid objects. Almost immediately, I discovered an item dense enough to have been flagged as a possible explosive. It was hair cream. But no clock, no bomb, and no explanation for the ticking. Behind the frosted glass partitions near the check-in counter, $5 million worth of bomb detection technology buzzed around me. None of it could help. Once the machine identified a suitcase as suspicious, it was my job to search it by hand. The only way to determine the source of the ticking came down to a $13-an-hour worker. I need to follow my trainer's instructions and go EDU, elbows deep in underwear. So far, I had seen the machines flag plenty of deodorant sticks, toothpaste tubes, and shoe heels, which showed up on the screen outlined in red. I had handled sex toys, machetes, and pistols. But the closest thing I had seen to a bomb were manufactured images on the screen created by the Threat Image Projection System, a software package developed by the government to make sure we were paying attention. The ticking was real enough, though, and I couldn't let the suitcase through until I figured out its origin. I took everything out, stacking clothes on the table. I turned the suitcase over once more and saw a bulge in a tiny pocket tucked between the rods for the extendable handle. It was an electric toothbrush that turned on when pressed against the table. Picking through other people's skivvies was my very small part in a very big government initiative. More than 4 million checked bags pass through the nation's 429 commercial airports on any given day. And since the beginning of the year, the Transportation Security Administration has been charged with examining all of them, on the slim chance that one contains a bomb. The first stop for checked bags is what's called a CTX machine, which uses conventional X-ray technology as well as a CT scanner that slices beams through a piece of luggage to determine the density and volume of the contents. The problem is that the CTX flags everything with the same volume and density as some explosives. These include peanut butter, toothpaste, chocolate, golf balls, shoe heels, blow pops, and believe it or not, live crabs. The CTX stops as many as 35% of all bags. A few alarms a day, and screeners will investigate every one thoroughly. A few dozen, and they become inured to the routine. The system would be better if more screeners were like one of the guys on my shift, a former military man. When he opened a bag, he purposefully examined each item. He turned tubes of toothpaste over in his hand. He shook golf balls and unfolded clothes. Most of my colleagues weren't so careful. One screener, a holdover from the private company that ran LaGuardia Security before the TSA took over, would sometimes take bags that were supposed to be searched by hand and just leave them on the examination table until another worker, who assumed they had already been cleared, sent them on the plane. One day I was at the controls of the CTX, which ejects bags like a toaster, bouncing them against a hard backstop. Safety regulations required moving the luggage before making even a cursory check. My fellow screener, however, started searching a suitcase where it landed and was hit square in the head by the next bag. That was our interim supervisor. The government would like to find a more sensitive machine that would support the CTX or a completely new system that would make the screening process more efficient. The goal is to find a machine that identifies every bomb while keeping false positives to a tolerable level. That's a formula sure to please passengers, not to mention my former colleagues on the front lines.
Beth Pinsker is a writer living in New York City. She worked for the Transportation Security Administration for 3 months. Her diary came to us in August. We're going to close the program tonight with one of our regular radio diary contributors, San Diego resident Sue Diaz. Sue's son, Roman, is an Army private who's been serving in and around Baghdad since May. Sue's heard only sparingly from her son since his unit moved into Iraq, but it was a phone conversation in June, just before he moved north from Kuwait, that she will never forget. In this radio diary, Sue Diaz recounts the phone call that transformed her relationship with her son.
I'm a writer. Putting words on paper is what I do. Ads, newsletters, a monthly humor column for a family magazine, an occasional opinion piece for the op-ed page of the local daily. But the words I'm looking at right now on the paper next to my laptop are unlike any I've ever written. The handwriting is mine. The paper's familiar, too, straight out of one of the letter-sized yellow legal pads I always keep handy on the desk here in my home office. But it's the words that are different. They're not mine. They belong to my son, Roman, a private in the infantry of the U.S. Army. He was in the Middle East the morning he called. The morning I wrote these words on this pale yellow paper, His unit had arrived in the desert staging area of Kuwait a week earlier, just after Baghdad fell. "We'll be leaving here soon. We're already packed, so this will be my last call for a while," he said. "There are no phones where we're going, no internet either." "And where's that?" I asked. "Can't say. It's a secret," he answered, continuing with a laugh. "Come on now, Mom. If I told you, I'd have to kill you." With some coaxing, I did learn that he and the rest of the men of Bravo Company would reach their ultimate destination 15 hours or so after their convoy headed north. "Does the place start with a B?" I pressed. "Mom," he answered with feigned exasperation. During his years as a teenager, I'd often heard the real thing. Back then, it had been my job to ask the questions. "Homework finished? What time does the movie end? Who's driving?" And it was his job, or so it seemed, to answer with as few syllables as possible. But the day Roman called, he wanted to talk. "Is Dad there?" he asked. "No, he's at a biotech conference today. Several months ago, my husband was laid off from his job as director of engineering at the big computer company where he'd worked for 27 years. He's been looking for work since then, and dreaming, too, of starting a company that develops software for the biotech industry." "Dad's not there. Shoot," Roman said, adding in a voice that trailed off, "there's something I really need to talk to him about." "Can I help?" I asked. No answer. "Roman?" "Well, okay, I guess so," he sighed from half a world away. I waited for the rest and wondered what it could be. "Got a pen, Mom?" "Yes." "And a piece of paper?" With each question, his voice gained authority. Then he told me what he hadn't wanted to tell me, how he'd taken out a life insurance policy for $275,000, the maximum the Army offers. "Now, if anything happens to me, here's what I want done with that money." I jumped in to stop that kind of talk. What mother wouldn't? "Don't be silly," I sputtered. "Nothing's going to happen to you. You'll stay safe, and when you come home, you'll have lots of stories to tell. Someday your grandchildren will ask about the time..." He cut me off. "Mom, please, just write this down." And so, cradling the phone between cheek and shoulder, I took my son's dictation, writing first a few words about his big sister, pay for Anne's college, then a line about taking care of me, and finally, a phrase for his father, help Dad start his company. "Did you get all that?" he asked. "Yes," I whispered. We chatted a few minutes more. Maybe it was about the weather, or the food, or the fellas he now hangs out with. I don't remember. My mind was still reeling with a changed reality, my heart twitching with a strange new sadness and a growing pride. When I'd answered the phone that day, I heard the voice of the boy I used to remind to eat his vegetables and pick up his socks, the same kid who balked at wearing a bike helmet, the teenager who played his hard rock CDs way too loud. I said, "Hi, Roman," to all those guys. But it was a man I said goodbye to.
Sue Diaz is a writer living in San Diego, California. Her son, Roman, is an Army private currently serving in Iraq. Listeners, if you have a story that you think would make a good radio diary, email us. The address is onpoint@wbur.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is...